Mr. Arthur, Reel 5. We'll take it out from when you arrived in New York, or you arrived in the Queen Mary.
Queen Mary, yeah.
What happened next, then?
We went across the water in one of their ferry boats, I remember, and got a train down to Asbury Park. Asbury Park was the sort of place where all the troops were gathered before they were sent off to their various directions. It was a boring place. Nothing went on there except you ate and slept.
Where were you accommodated?
In a hotel.
How comfortable was it?
Oh, it was comfortable enough. Comfortable enough. There was not much of a social life. There was not any life at all. Naval life didn't really exist. It was a holding centre. And fairly quickly from there, the ship's company was gathered together and we went up to Boston by train, which was a dreadful journey. It took about 6 hours and we were put in a siding halfway up and left there without any food or anything like that at all. And we got up to Boston and we were then taken over to the Wells Fargo building, which was taken over, it was a warehouse of some sort, was taken over as naval barracks. And they looked after us very well. The food was excellent. Accommodation was very good.
What was the accommodation for officers? Because we've heard from quite a lot of the men, but what was it like for an officer? What sort of room did you have? How many were in there?
Oh, I think I had my own cabin, and there was a general mess. There was a canteen there we all queued up, and I remember having to ask an American, what's this coleslaw then? And he said something rude about limes. But the food was American food and was not totally familiar. But I think everybody enjoyed it. They were very good. But then we went up to help to see the ship which had been commissioned, being built. And it was the idea was that we should familiarise ourselves with it while it was being built.
And this was HMS?
HMS Duckworth. And it was being built at the Bethlehem Hingham Yard.
And what were your first impressions of the Duckworth?
I'd come from a corvette and I noticed it was a bigger, a more commodious vessel with a lot more guns. And it looked pretty smart. It's not flashy, but fairly smart. I was quite excited. It seemed like it had a lot more speed than a corvette, and altogether it looked we could have some do some useful work in it.
Did you notice many of the differences from British built ships at the time? You know, because there were a lot of differences.
Oh yes, they were far more concerned with fire resistance. They had glass fibre curtains everywhere, which of course we took out when we got back. We put carpets down in the wardroom when we got back. We weren't too fussed about the, because we were much more worried about getting our feet wet than getting our beards singed. Anyway, one of the jobs we had to do was obviously to commission, which meant checking on the stores, checking on the troops, getting to know the men. They were all wandering around doing something useful. And my job there, one of them, was to liaise with the ladies ashore. There was a Mrs. Stead Rogers, who was the wife of a banker. And she ran a sort of hospitality centre for the troops and the officers, which was very effective. My job was to say, this chap is a professional musician or whatever he was, or he's a bit of a layabout, and she would find the right match. And the only rule that was ever made was the chap had to be back on board on Monday morning by 8 o'clock. And so she looked after that. It worked very well. I remember there because I'd run out of money. You do run out of money in America on the pay. I think my pay was 14 shillings a day, and Americans were much more. So every time Mrs. Rogers said to me, Lieutenant, would you like us to arrange for a weekend away? And I said, I'm far too busy, I'm sorry, I'd like to, there's a war and I can't. What I really meant to say was that I hadn't got any money left. I knew very well if I accepted hospitality, it wasn't totally one way, and I would have no money to pay my way. So I said no, and in the end she said to me, "Lieutenant, we've been talking about you and we're worried. We think you're working too hard, and if you don't take some time off, we shall speak to your captain." Now, that, I thought, would be a mistake. He might find out what I was really doing, which was not all that much, if I could help it. Captain then, at first the original captain, never turned up. We were going to have a Lieutenant Commander, RMVR, Lord Stanley of Alderley, who was quite a socialite. And they found a much better job for him. They sent him over to San Francisco as BNLO, British Naval Liaison Officer. And I think he spent his war explaining the war to Hollywood, but something like that. And he was replaced by a commander RMVR called Lloyd Williams, who'd been working, I think, in the gas board or something as administrator in peacetime. And he came over. He was a nice chap, but not very efficient as a naval officer. He'd become a commander because he'd been there for so long. And the reserve, mostly, I suspect, spent on board HMS President drinking gin. Who knows? But, so, anyway, I allowed myself to be persuaded by Mrs. Stead Rogers that, yes, I would accept hospitality. And she said to me, "Well, if you like to get the train on Saturday morning to Charles River Village, you'll be met. But you must promise to be on your best behaviour." And I said, "I'm always on my best behaviour." And so I was met by a lady who was charming, whose name was Mrs. Arthur Adams. But I'd been told that she was a widow, and the widow of the Secretary of the Navy, which was reasonably out of my social circle. So we get there, and we arrive in a house, which was obviously built a long time ago. I was told it was 1700 and something. And there was the family tree put up. John Adams, down John Quincy Adams, all the way down the line. I'd arrived at the top of Boston society. They were nice. When Mrs. Rogers asked me what I liked doing at weekends, I said, "Cutting down trees." So after breakfast, the butler comes in with an axe on a silver tray and said, he'd sharpened it up and he thought it would be about the right size. He said, "Would I let him know if I approved?" Because he'd had others. So I weighed it up. And he said, "Yes, well, if you'd like to follow me when you've had breakfast, we'll find you some trees." He said, what size tree had you in mind? And I said, "Well, medium size." So I went down and cut some trees down. But the social life took off from there. We had, I was there for two or three nights, most weekends.
Were you embarrassed about money? Or?
Oh, embarrassed, in one way, I hadn't any. Embarrassed, embarrassed in that sense. But money was desperately short for everybody. And hospitality, it was very difficult because the Americans hadn't any clue that you really didn't have any money. And when you might accept an invitation to go out for a meal with mum and dad and, of course, the sort of nubile daughter, and they give you a great wink, and you two young things would like to go on to a nightclub, wouldn't you? And you do that once, and that's your money gone for a long time. But I was there suddenly going into nightclubs, and I was living the life old Riley. But anyway, I'm 55 years later, I'm still in touch with one of the young ladies who turned up, who was Mrs. Adams' niece, and it seemed to me be diplomatic to favour that particular lady when I was asked which one I prefer to spend the weekend with me next weekend. So there we are. But that's nothing to do with it. We get to Duckworth, we have a commissioning ceremony.
What was that like? What do you remember of the commissioning ceremony?
Oh, it was an usual sort of a chap from the dockyard handing it over to the captain. The Mrs. Stead Rogers, in fact, launched Duckworth. She was at the party, we all had drinks, and it was all organised on naval lines. It was all quite fun. And, of course, I turned up with three or four young women, my acquaintance, who were quite happy to be on board. They thought it was quite fun.
Now, what happened after the commissioning then?
Well, we went off to Bermuda.
Did you have any sea trials or gunnery trials before you went to Bermuda?
I'm sure we did. We would have to take over. But basically, when they were over, it was a question of fairly boring, because they were just going and seeing how fast or slow they could go. And I don't think we had any gunnery trials particularly, but certainly sea trials were there, see how the engines held, your ship handled.
And what was your accommodation on board then?
I shared a cabin with another lieutenant.
How big was it? What was it like? You know,
it was tiny. Two bunks, one on top of the other. Two bureau-type desks, one for each of us. And a safe for the confidential books. I was in charge of CBs. And there wasn't really room for both of you to standing up at the same time. Sitting down was all right.
And you had bunks, you said?
Oh, yes. One on top of the other. The usual sort of accommodation. It wasn't spacious accommodation.
What about the wardroom?
The wardroom was quite small.
What did you have in there?
Oh, a Maltese steward, I do remember, I think. But I can't remember much about it, except it, we fed and watered there. And I can remember a bit more about on the upper deck.
Well, what about the upper deck, the arrangement and the bridge and such?
The bridge, it worked.
What was the layout?
As I remember it, they're the usual two compasses, the standard compass and the Armagyro compass. And I'd already been round when I was in New York. On the way up, I'd spent a day at the Armagyro works to see how it was made. It meant nothing to me and not much to them, I don't think, while we were there. It was something for us to keep out of mischief. But it wasn't a very satisfactory compass in more ways than one.
And what was the problem with it?
Couldn't face up to, well, rough weather.
What was the problem? It bounced.
Well, it went. That's why you have a standard compass. Once every watch, you check your standard compass against the gyro, and you hope that they match. And if they don't, you've got problems. You could be where you don't want to be. Or.
And what else was on the bridge?
A lot of voice pipes, all nicely polished brass that you spoke down. And below the bridge was the wheelhouse. And as officer watch on the bridge, you'd be on your own, perhaps. Conning the ship, you would pass your orders down the voice pipe to the quartermaster, who would respond in the right way. He'd do what you told him to do, and there'd be a chap on the telegraphs there to alter the engine speed and so on, if you ever had to, which you didn't do that. Usually it was the captain's job. But most of the time, you were steering a course and making sure you kept on the course.
Now, what do you remember of that? You went to Bermuda first. That was your proper working up.
That was where we worked up, and it was dreadful weather on the way across, and I was sick for 4 days, badly, badly sick.
Now, they had a reputation for rolling.
Oh, yes.
Was that justified?
Absolutely justified. At a later date, when we got back to the UK, we were sent out. They didn't tell us until we'd left harbour. We were sent out to find bad weather. And we had on board with us a representative of the Armagyro company to see how it stood up to bad weather. What they didn't have was someone to see how he stood up to bad weather. He was totally incapacitated. It was a waste of time. And when we went out, and I've never seen seas like it, somewhere south of Greenland, bloody cold, and literally the sea was twice as tall as the ship's mast, like the side of a house. Three-story house, it was towering above you, and you'd ride up on it thinking, well, that wave that's breaking at the top there, it didn't break over you. When you got to the top, the wind blew rather faster, then you went down the other side, but then you rolled, and we measured the roll to be 47 degrees. And I remember looking at one of these occasions, I'd recovered my sea legs by then, and you're on the bridge, and you had a jackstay rig between the two compasses, and you hung on to that because you couldn't. Your feet were not really on the deck very much, so where you could find a foothold. And I remember looking over the edge of the bridge at the funnel, which was very near the water. And I said, oh, if that wave breaks over, is he going to go down the funnel? But it never did. And then you righted yourself and went over on the other beam. And it took, we measured, 7 seconds to go from 47 degrees on one way to 47 degrees on the other. And you got thrown about a bit, and so did everything else. They were dreadful. And this was apparently due to the fact that they were designed originally with torpedo tubes, which were not fitted. And that extra top weight would have made them much more stable. As it was, they were bottom heavy and whipped about. And boy, did they whip. Anyway, we get out to Bermuda in the end and we work up there.
What sort of working up exercises did you do? Do you remember what you did?
Oh, there'd be gunnery trials and depth charge trials.
And what was your job on the ship? You know, what was your action station?
Action station was on one of the forward guns.
The three-inch guns?
Three-inch guns.
And what were your duties there?
I never did discover. I was officer in charge, which meant that everybody else knew what they were doing, and I was to make sure that that they did what they were supposed to do. It's really an odd, very odd job if you're in charge of guns. So you can't do anything. They point where they, you know, you indicate the target, perhaps, and that's as far as it goes. It's up to them to, the gun there and the trainer, to get on the target. I suppose you relay messages from the bridge to the gun's crew. That's, I suppose, the answer, and make sure they're carried out.
And what did you think of the 3-inch gun? Because it's not a usual weapon in the British Navy, Royal Navy.
No, it's not. It was ineffective.
In what way?
There was trouble with the firing of it. It sometimes went off pop when it shouldn't have gone. And there was apparently a general fault through all the guns. There was something to do with the pin that was stuck. And when you closed the breech, the pin became unstuck and fired the gun the moment you closed the breech, which is a bit embarrassing. Because you weren't quite sure where the gun was pointing half the time. Their most useful function, actually, was lobbing up star shell. And a star shell is a great weapon. It illuminates the target and he can't see you. You throw it the other side of the target and you see him in silhouette. But that star shell doesn't show you to him. He doesn't know where it's come from.
And so your prime weapon was not the gun, it was the depth charge.
Oh, absolutely. And hunting submarines, which is what we were, the depth charges were the lethal weapon. Oddly enough, my very first corvette, the Anemone, sunk a U-boat with its 4-inch gun, which is a 1914-18 model. And that was an Italian submarine with 5-inch guns. But Anemone, we had a very experienced gun there, and he managed to sink it. But we wouldn't have expected to sink very much with that little pea shoot. It was mostly there for lobbing up star shell.
Now, so the gunnery trials are one thing you'd be having. What other sorts of trials would you have at Bermuda?
Yeah, testing the depth charges.
Now, you wouldn't be involved in that?
No. At action stations, there would be somebody else on the depth charge rails to sort that one out.
Did you have much knowledge of anti-submarine warfare? You know,
we knew the theory, but in fact, it wasn't our job to know about how it worked. It was our job to do what we were told to do. When you've got a battle going, very few people know what's going on. Even the captain may not know what's going on outside his own ship. General things. You are given a job to do, you do it. And that's part of a team, and you don't have to know. Quite a point. You see ships being sunk, but you don't know what the hell is going on. Are you winning? Are you losing? You don't know. You don't have to worry. It's not your job to worry about that. You just get on and load the depth charges or stand by on the gun and wait for things to happen. But Bermuda, it's a pleasant place.
Did you do the abandoned ship test?
No, we didn't abandon ship. What we did do was to have a boarding party exercise when we boarded another destroyer escort, as if it was an enemy, and we tried to take it over. I got in a fair bit of trouble there because I was didn't stop when I was told to.
What were you doing?
Well, we had a few Mills bombs and so on, which I was putting down voice pipes and things like that. No, we were. I was reckoned to be a bit over enthusiastic. It was an exercise, not for real. But they shouldn't have encouraged us, I think.
And any other exercises? Navigation exercise?
No, there'd be the usual ones about anchor work, going to a buoy, the seamanship, testing of taking a ship in tow, for example. The sort of thing that you don't often have to do, but it's just as well to know the routine when you have to.
Would it be the captain who's learning this, or would occasionally stand aside and tell one of the junior officers?
Oh, no,
to do
he
it?
Doesn't. No, he's in charge, and he certainly wouldn't. Even the first lieutenant wouldn't be expected to take over from the captain. Not on it, not in training. But as far as I can remember.
Now, which captain did you have at this point?
Well, at that time, we'd take, I think, Commander Mills had taken over. He was Commander RN.
Now, what were your first impression of Commander Ronnie Mills?
Well, he was Royal Navy to start with, not reserve, and very pusser indeed. He was obviously hadn't got too much time for us, the reserves. We were, after all, non-professional. He'd spend his whole life going through Dartmouth and all the other things. He was a very professional seaman and a very ambitious one. He was at that peculiar state in his career when it was make or break. The reputation he made for himself, the senior officer and escort group, was standing in good stead when it came to later promotion. After the war, when we'd all gone to do our jobs, he was going to still be there.
So he's not only the captain of the ship, he was the
He was senior officer escort group.
Which escort group was it? Do you remember the number? They can look it up if you don't remember.
Yeah, I think it was B3. I can't remember. But
what was he like as a bloke? I mean, you can be strict or...
he wasn't very friendly. He was remote, I think was the best way to put it. And he brought his own staff with him. He got a commissioned gunner who was also very passive and also looking, I think, for promotion stakes after the war. It's perfectly reasonable they should be. Our first lieutenant was a Lieutenant R.N. Hanning Lee.
What was he like?
A bit subdued. I think he was under the influence of the Commander Mills. And the pilot, the navigating officer, was a sub-lieutenant, RN. So we had a full complement of RN.
Do you remember his name?
Yes, Crosley. I remember his name because he came from the Crosley Carpet family. And when we got back to the UK, his family firm very kindly carpeted our wardroom. I don't think it was flame retardant carpet. It was very much better than the Americans that left us. But no, he was an amiable young chap. But of course, all these RN people were career sailors.
And what other officers did you have? Or was
it? I was three or four RNVR.
And how did you get on with it?
Oh, very well. We had a nice chap called Hill. And Hill was, I think, being a stockbroker. He was peacetime RNVR. And he was a senior watchkeeper. And you had, I suppose, about six watchkeepers. You only needed... only three watchkeepers, but you'd have another couple who would be there as well. The watchkeepers, the officer watch, where you were 4 hours on and 8 hours off.
Now, can you just run through what they did? You mentioned briefly before, but what would you do when you were watchkeeping officer?
In harbour, you're responsible for running the routine of the ship.
And what does that involve?
Making sure that the daily orders are kept to, which includes making sure that the bosun's mate calls up spirits at the right time, and that if there's a boat to be alongside at 10 o'clock to take the captain off, the boat is alongside at 10 o'clock. You're responsible for the housekeeping, if you like. Any stores that come on board, you make sure that the paperwork is correct. Any working parties, you make sure that they report. And, of course, any defaulters are brought in front of you. If anybody is, there are not many of those, except in the in the forenoon watch when you get the people coming adrift off leave, and then they're brought in front of you. And then your job is to act as a interrogating officer, and you make notes of what goes on and what the excuses are. And then you don't have any power, well, you don't have much power, if any, to punish them, but you refer them to commander. You say, commander's report. And then, when that happens, you go down to the commander's table where he hears the defaulters, and you give him the facts of the case, a summary of it, which saves a lot of time. And then the commander says to the chap, do you agree with what the lieutenant's other said? And the fellow say yes or no, and they go on from there. That's the sort of thing in the officer watch on the quarter deck. Now,
that's in harbour.
In harbour.
Now, what about at sea?
At sea, you're on the bridge, and your job is exactly the same, making sure the routine is run, except that you don't have stores, you don't have boats to worry about. You do have to bear in mind that as soon as you see a light, it could be a lighthouse, it could be another ship, whatever, you report it immediately to either the captain or the navigating officer. So you are his eyes. He can then relax in his cabin, knowing that if anything is happening untoward at all, he will be informed. You're responsible to see the lookouts, keep a good lookout. You're responsible for seeing that, for example, that there's the anchor, for example, could be rattling around. You make sure that the buffer, the chief bosun mate, is alerted to see if there's anything to be done about it. It's housekeeping again. It is, I think. Now, of course, the other thing at sea is the working part. Is you're still having, in the forenoon watch, you still get the off-watch hands fell in and painting ship or cleaning ship or doing the chores that are necessary. But it's a responsible job in the sense that you're left on your own and told if anything happens, tell the person that is concerned. You don't have anything to do except to tell other people, but you make sure that you don't miss anything.
And did you enjoy that responsibility?
Oh, yes. I did. It was quite exciting.